Hello and welcome to the last Texas Tribune Tribcast of the year. My name is Elise Hugh, a political reporter at the Tribune, and we've prepared a very special episode for you this week because it's a mashup of our favorite discussions over the last 9 episodes of the Tribcast and our favorite bloopers. In mid-December, in Tribcast Episode 7, Ross and Evan led discussion on a topic that caught up on where the GOP gubernatorial race was at. This discussion ended up arousing a lot of attention from our friends on both sides of the aisle.
We'll start with Ross and Evan, because you guys are kind of tag-teaming this topic on the Republican race.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, we have two prominent candidates, one of which hasn't really started her campaign in a way we can detail in bloody detail here. But and then we've got the spoiler. You know, there were 4 or 5 House races in the last elections that were determined by Libertarian candidates. In other words, the person who won the race won with less than 50% of the vote because there was a third-party candidate on the ballot. And we have this governor's race that we're going into where Deborah Medina, who's kind of a – she's a Republican. She's a Wharton County chair. She's kind of a teabag candidate. She sort of proudly holds the label.
She says she proudly takes that, yes.
Yeah, and she's, you know, she's – in most of the polls, she's showing up in the 5 to 10% range. That's perfect spoiler range. She could throw this into a runoff and you know, judging from what we're seeing right now, she would take votes away, I think, from Rick Perry.
But to your point, Ross, about how one of the two candidates hasn't really started her campaign – it's December. It's approaching the middle of December.
Well, and her campaign would jump up and down and probably will when they hear this. Then I say they haven't started. But, you know, you can't find anyone who sort of is defending outside of the campaign itself, who's sort of defending the energy of this campaign, defending the message of this. We're talking about Kay Hutchison, and we should say.
We should say. She who shall be named.
She who shall be named. It's the sort of, if you go to a voter and you say, if you vote for this candidate, what will happen? Or what do you expect to happen? Or what do you expect to get? And there's not really an answer to that question.
I want to note on the Medina thing that our poll, at least, the Texas Tribune UT poll, found that Medina was at 7% and still found that Perry was ahead by 12%. I mean, the interesting thing is it wasn't Medina took 7% away and therefore it was a close race. It was, but for Medina, the margin might have been larger.
Right.
I want to be very careful. I know you're not saying this, and I certainly don't want to say it, not to write Senator Hutchison off in this race. This race is by no means over. But I think it is crazy for anybody in the press to pretend that it is the competitive race today that the Hutchison campaign would like us to believe. She is behind. She is behind in every measure. And if there is a poll that the Hutchison campaign has that they're sitting on that shows her competitive, please produce it immediately. Because the narrative of this race, which of course doesn't determine the outcome, all it determines is what people talk about between now and the outcome. The narrative of this race is rapidly becoming that he's way ahead and that her campaign's in trouble. And what can she possibly do at this point to fix it? It's unfair to her, but that's become the narrative. And I'm not sure that either she or her campaign is necessarily helping change that narrative.
Could it possibly be, this is kind of a conspiracy theory, but could it possibly be a strategic move? I mean, we know and it's been published that Kay Bailey Hutchison originally wanted a short campaign, something that ran from January to March, really, and largely on the airwaves. Could they essentially be kind of dark right now and getting ready for some sort of massive push close to the end?
You can make that argument. You know, we've talked before about two primaries here. One of them is a financial primary where you're basically trying to impress the finance people around the state so that they will give you the money so that when you get to the real primary, you have the $1.5 million to $1.8 million a week it takes to advertise to the whole state of Texas. So, you know, Kay Hutchison is competitive in the sense that she's got a pile of money. We'll see the reports in mid-January on how much she and Perry have raised in the last 6 months. But, you know, I expect it to be a $30 to $40 million 2 month primary. That's a lot of TV stuff. You know, I wish I owned a television station. But I think she'll be competitive in that way. But what's going on now is if people are perceiving, you know, sort of the insiders are perceiving that this isn't, she's not really putting up a fight yet, that's the finance primary. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see in January that Perry has had a more successful second half of 2009 financially than Hutchison has.
Well, and ask yourself, Ben, if there are major donors who are sitting here going, I'm going to write a check to her. Is there a motivation for them to do that?
There isn't. And I think the idea of public perception of what her campaign is doing right now, you know, I've got a friend, longtime Republican, who talked to me this week and was always a Kay Bailey Hutchison supporter, talked to me this week and said, you know, I really like Bill White. Now, that's just one person. That's just one moderate Republican friend of mine. But but that's, you know, we talked on and on about the idea that a massive or a bloody, rather, Republican primary could have Kay Bailey Hutchison supporters, if she indeed loses, looking for to either stay out of the race or possibly looking at a moderate Democrat. Well, I have now one friend who has. Now, he didn't say he was going to vote for White, but he said, "Boy, you know, I sure do like White."
I'm doubtful that the KP, if Kay were to lose, and again, let's be very clear, we're not suggesting she is going to lose, we're not predicting she's going to lose, but if Kay were to lose, I would be very reluctant to say here today that I think a lot of her people are going to gravitate to Mayor White. On the other hand, I think that as she did in her announcement on Monday, she does have a case to make for electability. And, you know, our poll showed that she was a much more electable Republican in the fall against a generic Democrat than the governor was. And the reality is it is widely held, just as it's widely held from a narrative standpoint, Ben, from a perception standpoint, that she's behind now. It is also widely held that if you get past the primary and were she to emerge victorious as opposed to the governor, she would be a stronger candidate in the fall against Mayor White than he would. That seems not to be in dispute in most quarters. At all.
In all of our polling, she ran ahead of the Democrats by a greater margin
than the governor.
Right?
I want to come back at least to this idea that you just put out, though, that somehow maybe the Hutchison campaign is waiting until January to March, and this was their plan all along. I'm hearing John McCain's voice in my head following Labor Day in 08 saying, not entirely without irony, of the Obama campaign, now we have them right where we want them. I mean, the idea that somehow the master plan was to be 12 points behind going into the first of the year and then suddenly to overwhelm the governor with an ad campaign that was somehow going to sway voters, to me, is just crazy.
Maxwell Smart.
But I just feel
Rudy
like
Giuliani did that when he focused on Florida, right?
Right.
Oh, by the time we get to Florida, I'll be ready.
And the only person that Giuliani ended up beating was John Connolly for the record of spending the most to get the least in the history of presidential campaigns. I mean, the fact is you do not wait until January to launch a campaign in a state this large where the amount of money spent is going to be this much and hope to overtake somebody who, whatever you think of him as governor, is a hell of a campaigner.
So let me play contrarian here, just sort of argue against what we've been saying. I mean, you know, the argument for Hutchison here is that she remains a very popular, very well-liked politician. It remains a red state. And if she can get past Rick Perry because voters think that they prefer her politics or because they're tired of Perry. He's been in office 10 years. That may or may not turn out to be an effective argument. She has enough money to make her argument in a broad way. I mean, she'll walk in with $12 million, and that's not nothing. And when she throws this up, it may change the race immediately.
Of course, there's been no shortage of action on the Democratic side of the race for governor as well. Here's a look at a talk we had back in mid-November before Bill White got in the race.
I don't think that the Netroots Democrats, the base Democrats, to the degree that there are passionate Democrats still in Texas who are active in campaigns, and there are, they tend to be base Democrats, not conservative Democrats. The theory here is that Schieffer was somehow going to win over those people. There was no way that he was going to win over the sort of burnt orange, Texas blue, Lone Star Project.
How big a deal are those guys in a primary anyway?
Who
the Netroots Democrats,
the
base
Democrats.
Democrats? Well, they're
I make a distinction between the Netroots Democrats and the base Democrats.
I don't make much of a distinction because they all play in the same pool. They may some swim in the deep end and some swim in the shallow, but the fact is they're all essentially the more liberal wing of the party, just as in the Republican primary, who tends to turn out as the more Republican right wing of that party tends to turn out in greater numbers with greater passion. For Tom Schieffer to have won that primary, he had to have appealed to the left word base of the Democratic Party, and he showed absolutely no sign of doing so. And he seems, even today, to not fully appreciate that he had to connect with those people in order to win a primary, even against the likes of Kinky Friedman and Hank Gilbert.
This is a really interesting question. It's going to happen in the Republican primary, too, is if you go too far toward the, let's call it the base or the wing of your party, if you go to the right wing in the Republican primary, if you go to the left wing in the Democratic primary, do you make yourself the leader in a primary only to make yourself ineligible in November?
I mean, Ask Rick Perry.
You run so far right. Well, you know, do you
Rick
run
Perry
so far right? You
had
run
a
so far left.
In the past.
Right.
But
well, he didn't need to pivot 4 or 3 years ago because I mean he didn't. I don't know that he did pivot. Picking up 39% of the statewide vote,
which makes Bill White such an interesting question, though, right? So now there's talk that of the likelihood that right. Houston Mayor Bill White will enter this race
by December 4th. It's going to be nice to drop possibly and perhaps.
Right? And he's doing this 10-day waiting period.
It's
right,
sort of like Hillary Clinton's listening tour.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Please right. weigh in. Please right. tell right. me what you think I should run for.
Tell me how much money you'd be willing to give me if I were to run.
That's a lot of this right there.
But remember that, again, just to stay on Schieffer for 1 second before we pivot sure. to White, the other problem with Schieffer, which White doesn't necessarily solve, is that, to quote our friend Ken Herman, what he said about Tony Sanchez, that Tom Schieffer had the Bob Krueger-like ability to take a crowd in a frenzy and whip them into a coma.
Yeah, this is...
And the fact is, the pivot from Tom Schieffer to Bill White in the excitement department is not
natural.
Much of a pivot yeah, at all.
Right.
That's right. That's right.
Right?
We're at an accounting convention. It's just amazing. It's yeah. you know,
the idea that somehow Bill White is the savior is hilarious until he opens his mouth.
We've gone from the stamp collector to the coin collector. It's just really fascinating.
You know, I'm told, though, that he's very good on television... and in church. So his well-produced campaign
White.
Ads, right, right. When he was reelected by margins of 91 and 86% in Houston, on television, apparently he can communicate well. And so a lot of the statewide race is still waged over the air. So that's one. And then B, apparently he's very good in churches.
Well,
but
he's actually quite a religious person. Not religious in the sense of, you know, he's no Joel Osteen, but he's religious in the right. sense that he takes his faith very seriously, and his faith manifests itself in the way he views his world, to the point that some of his critics on the left have accused him of being excessively moral. And so it's
always,
interesting.
Always a hard swipe in politics.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, you're just
you're
too
just
moral.
Too
to be
moral.
A
I
kept you out of the South Carolina governor's race, I think.
That's right.
I guess
oh.
yeah, not, these days it certainly does, right? I do think that White's faith is going to be an interesting question here. You know, is to what degree does his embrace of faith put off some of the people who traditionally
believe. Well, what's the contrast? I mean, you know, this is about electoral politics is about differences. I mean, somebody comes in and says, you know, I'm not as moral as he is. I don't think that, I don't know.
Well, but you understand.
I'm thinking of Kinky Friedman.
I go
somehow.
Hiking in Appalachia.
You understand every week, church, that that there are some people who see that the line between politics and religion should be solid and not dotted. And so you even had criticism of Barack Obama,
right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
wearing his faith and his attendance in church on his sleeve during the presidential campaign.
I just have a hard time seeing that being a liability in Texas.
Right.
It could be an asset. I mean, you can pull a moderate who goes to church every week and right. you know doesn't mind the right. fact that a Democrat is now coming out talking about how what they do on Sunday helps shape
other
their
than
world
watch
view.
Football, right?
Right.
I think what changes here, though. I mean, the big change in the table here is that what was seen by us and by a lot of people as a non-competitive race, or you know, competitive only under you know limited circumstances, now looks like competitive under less limited circumstances. I mean, this could really be interesting. The Democratic primary looks at this moment to me like Bill White and the Four Dwarfs. And
you think there will be a primary? You don't think that Kinky and Hank Gilbert and those guys are going to be persuaded
Let's
by Boyd Ritchie?
Let's not mention my favorite Farouk Shami.
Or Farouk Shami to get out of the race. I mean, that's the question.
I don't know that they will. I mean, they're interesting in several regards. Kinky Friedman has the highest name ID in the polls. He's the one voters know about. That's worth something. Farouk Shami has $10 million, you know?
That's worth $10
something.
Million.
Dollars. Well, that's worth exactly $10 million. That buys name ID. I mean, that's you know, Hank Gilbert, as you said, has the message but doesn't seem to be able to get it out. So, I mean, there's some interesting things here. But Bill White's sort of the tallest of the candidates at this moment. But then you get into a prospect of a general election that is at least interesting at the outset. I don't know if it'll still be interesting in September or October, how this will all play out, who wins the Republican primary, et cetera, but Bill White's a different sort of candidate than Tom Schieffer or any of the other four.
I just want to note that this is turning rapidly into the heir apparent governor's race. You've got Rick Perry, Governor Goodhair. You've got Kay Bailey Hutchison, often referred to as the Breck Girl. You've got Kinky Friedman, whose nickname is based on his own kinky hair. You've got Farouk Shami, who made his money through hair, and you got Bill White, whose distinct lack of it is one of his most noticeable features.
Well, you guys saw this.
How did we end up here?
You saw this text that John Sharp was sending around. This is John Sharp, the former controller and now U.S. Senate candidate, if there's a race. What we have now is a gov race between good hair, big hair, no hair, and let me do your hair. So, well, there you go.
Sharp continues to make us laugh.
We hope you've gotten to know some of the personalities on the Tribcast, too, notably our managing editor, Ross Ramsey, and his knack for using folksy idioms to describe various situations in Texas politics. In fact, we've made a montage for you of some of our favorites.
Right. This is the old joke, you know, the veterinarian and the taxidermist start a store together, and the slogan is either way you get your dog back. Ate crow in front of a national audience. But
well, yeah, we've got this, you know, this is the nine cars in a fog. You know?
Carson, remember Johnny Carson, kids?
You know, it's like mother always told you, you know, truth will out.
You know, they're sort of in the chirp or get off the perch stage here, and I think some of them are going to say...
I never heard that version of that expression when I was growing up.
I actually got that one from Gib Lewis.
That's the podcast version, right? It's a family podcast.
It's exactly right.
Gobble, gobble.
We've also collected a montage of some of our favorite bloopers from Ben Philpott, who's reporting for the Tribune and KUT News based here in Austin. Here's Ben's bloopers.
Hello.
Roll Tide, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Hook 'em horns, Ross. Evan.
Gosh, you know, I don't know. To the question of
the state of Texas was in line to get over $500,000.
Half a billion, excuse me.
Thank you.
Do they stick their money against Hobson in a general election, or do they stick their money against Irving, Texas?
Linda Harper Brown.
Yeah. Thank you.
And then you have the out and out rhino hunters. These are the candidates like Joe. Patronus, no, I'm getting his name wrong. Sorry.
Joe the Plumber?
It's not Joe the Plumber, and I'm going to just completely forget his name right now. You know, I mean, gosh,
I was told there would be pie.
And a big apology to Ben Philpott for that one time in episode 7 where I hung you out to dry.
You get the feeling in campaigns like this that these otherwise really, really great, successful, smart business people walked into some enterprise without any kind of a plan at all. It's very interesting.
Unfortunately, isn't that what Senator Hutchison's campaign looks like right now?
Kind of does.
I mean.
And that brings us full circle.
Thank you. I'll be getting the death threats to Ben Philpott. Thanks, there.
On behalf of Evan
P-H-I-L-P-O-T-T.
That's a selection of some of our favorite moments from the Tribcast. Since early November. It's hard to believe we only started a few months ago, but we have an exciting year and many years ahead. Thank you for listening, and thanks again to Nakia for providing the music.